afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Saturday Afternoon with me, Carolyn Yeager, on August 2nd, 2014. A big thanks to my contributor from Phoenix, Arizona, who once again sent a $20 bill to my post office box with the message, "Keep on trucking." That's always a cheerful indicator, but someone I haven't heard from for a while is Jaime Schwartz from Tel Aviv in Florida. I'm wondering if Jaime has deserted me. But if he has, he was a great friend while he was around, and I want to thank him. I still thank him for all that he did. So yesterday was Friday, the 70th anniversary of Warsaw Uprising, according to the polls. And in my opinion, and the opinion of even many Polish people, that uprising was a very stupid and hopeless decision on their part. It was a kind of the blundering move that is so typical of the Poles. They are brave fighters, I think, but sometimes stupid and too boastful. They overestimate themselves and underestimate the enemy. Or they don't even think along those lines. They just act emotionally and impetuously. But they did have some reason for why they did what they did, even though they didn't have much chance of... I guess they thought maybe somebody would come in and help them once they got started, as so often is thought, and people are disappointed. But I would say that the Poles are so very different from the Czechs, who are more cautious and consider their long-range interests. When I was over there in Europe, I thought the Czechs seemed more like a better people than the Poles. And my friend Willie Christman had the opposite view and always liked the Poles, pretty much liked the Poles and saw their good side. And he said that for him, the Czechs were very sneaky and untrustworthy. And he's probably right, probably knows more about it than I do. But going on with the Warsaw Uprising and the celebrations and the commemoration in Poland, I read in an AP article that on Friday, Poland honored the fighters and victims, they call them victims, of a 1944 rebellion against Nazi Germany by laying wreaths, lighting candles, and singing insurgent tunes to march the 70th anniversary. What happened was that on August 1st, 1944, thousands of poorly armed young city residents rose up against the German forces to try to take control of Warsaw ahead of the advancing Soviet army. They held on for 63 days in the cutoff, in the city that was cut off from the outside, before being forced to surrender. And this article states, this is from probably more from the Polish point of view, that 200,000 fighters and civilians were killed in street fights and in German bombings. But in truth, the leaders of the rebellion are responsible for all these deaths, for encouraging this rebellion to take place. And they say that the Nazis expelled the survivors and set the city ablaze. Well, what happened was during the siege, the Luftwaffe halted all aerial attacks for 3 days to give the Poles the opportunity to evacuate the city. The fact is that the German Wehrmacht, too, was the legal authority in Warsaw, and the resistance was illegal. So what they were doing was internationally illegal and couldn't be defended. But, of course, it's always defended based on feeling, emotion and where the victory ends up. So President Bronislaw Komorowski, president of Poland, joined the surviving insurgents. See, they call them insurgents rather than rebels, resistance, or illegal fighters, or terrorists even. which they would be called in one of the democracies today if they were doing that against the reigning democratically elected authorities. And they call it a heroic struggle that remains a source of pride for the Poles. But as I said, you know, it really wasn't heroic, except let me give you another version here. In Deutsche Welle newspaper, German newspaper, had an article that reads that on August 1st, the Polish in 1944, the Polish Home Army launched its rebellion with the aim of liberating Warsaw, the capital, that symbolized Polish independence from its German occupiers. Now, Deutsche Welle is totally on the side of the Allies, on the side of the Poles, totally hateful toward Third Reich Germany and all of its actors and players. So they say that 15,000 rather than, you know, 15,000 insurgents, they call them, and 150,000 civilians lost their lives. So that doesn't quite add up to 200,000 like the other story says. But in the 63 days of fighting, well, what happened? Why they actually did that was that the Poles wanted to beat the Russians to the liberation because the Red Army was on its way, and when it came into Poland, it was going to declare itself the liberator of the Poles and of Poland and take charge. And the Poles wanted to retain their independence and their home rule. And so that's why they decided to try this Warsaw Uprising so that they would already have liberated their own capital city by the time the Russians got there. And the Russians wouldn't be able to take credit for it and subjugate the Poles so easily. But they weren't up to it. I mean, they couldn't. Defeat the German forces that were there, and the Germans were not going to give up just so that the Poles could have their little thing with the Soviet Union, could accomplish their goal there. So it was kind of a pointless effort because Poland went under the rule of the Soviet Union, the communist rule anyway. And then after the war was over, during the communist regime, the uprising was a taboo topic, and you couldn't even mention it, or if it was mentioned, it was criticized as an irresponsible and unwise act amounting to collective suicide. So that's partly where that came from. The Russians were the Soviets were putting out that story that was a foolish thing for the Poles to do, and they committed suicide in Warsaw by doing that. So what's being battled over here is who the heroes were. The Soviet Union wanted to claim the Red Army as the heroes, the liberating heroes of Warsaw, and the Poles wanted to be able to claim themselves as the heroes of Warsaw, and today they do. But under communist rule, they were not able to. But since 1991 or so, they now can put out their own story about what happened in Poland and how the Poles behaved. And they see it today in Poland as a victory over cowardice and fear. See, they say we didn't let cowardice and fear get us down under the repressive rule of the Nazis. We stood up to them, even though we didn't succeed. It's still a heroic story that shows that we resisted strongly and we were very brave and so on. So now this commemoration is being played up because it's the 70th. 1944, was whatever happened in 1944 is having its 70th anniversary this year in 2014. So, but this, there's an exhibition that was jointly put together by Poland and Germany, and it has Germany absolutely going along with the Polish point of view in total, that that the Poles were brave fighters, that they fought for their, you know, resisted the repressive, horrible Nazi regime, and they fought for their freedom. And the Germans just go along with that, and that's the nature of the exhibit, which is in Germany today. They're probably there in Poland, but there's also one in Germany, and I'm not sure what city it's in. It might be in Berlin. So that's that. Now going on to my topic about the Platterhoff speech and the racial meaning of it, and it contains a cast of characters that I really don't want to be talking about, but I don't have any choice if I'm going to talk about what's coming up with this. And it's kind of like the same phony revisionist stuff that goes on with the Polish Warsaw Uprising. But why I'm bringing it up today is because it just, things have come to my attention, and things have been said and done recently, and I think it needs a response. I think someone needs to put another side on it, to bring the other side to it. And I don't see anybody paying much attention to it or doing this. And this is a question that, for me, is among the most important in my idea of what's important. The idea of what was Germany's attitude, what was Hitler's attitude, and what was National Socialist Germany's attitude toward race. And so recently, someone emailed me that Deanna Spingola and Veronica Clark had been had done a program together and had ridiculed me on the program, and I eventually tried to listen to it, and did, and I didn't hear any ridicule of me, but I did hear some amazing nonsense from Veronica Clark, and it's not harmless nonsense in my opinion, but I thought at the time, well, just leave it so as not to bring attention to Veronica Clark. I thought it's not important enough what she's saying, and It's important, but, you know, I don't want to bring attention to her, as she seems to have gone off the radar a little bit, and I think that's where she should be. But now she appears to be making something of a comeback with the help of some of her friends, among whom is Deanna. She's not doing anything too different, but they're playing down some of the more bizarre things that she was talking about and blogging about, in this past year. I don't remember, I guess it was last winter when it kind of came up big, last fall and winter, early spring maybe. But the other day then, so I left that alone. I thought I'm not going to say anything. But then the other day I heard someone somewhere about Veronica Clark and Fritz Berg being on with John Friend. So I looked at John's blog, and I did find Fritz Berg on his show on July 29th. So I went and started listening to it and, you know, moved around, kept moving up to see if I could hear Clark's voice, and finally I did. So I took what she said there and went back to Deanna's show and listened to, made sure about that again. And I thought from these two shows, you know, I just got this idea that Clark is coming back again, and she's being accepted in circles that, in my opinion, shouldn't be accepting her after all that has come out about her. But that's how these things go in this movement, so-called truth movement, or with radio shows and so on, and with people who are just interested in hearing different things and don't really have the overall idea of what is importantly right and how much damage is done by opinions and information and input that tears at the fabric of what's important to us, and people don't care much about that. A lot of the reason is because these people don't see don't take race seriously. There's more and more and more people who, maybe there's the same amount, but who want to make we don't have to be so particular about it. Well, we don't have to be so hard line about it. Well, we should be more tolerant of one another and so on. So we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about tolerance here. At least it comes up quite a bit. And I'll say next that Veronica Clark, in my opinion, and I have nothing against her personally. I really don't. And it's not personal. But I have to point out that I think she puts out a lot of falsehoods and what I would even consider lies, but they're not. She could certainly deny that because they're her opinion, and she finds sources for things. She comes up with a statement from this book, that book, and what she does is she selects information from here and there, and then puts it together in her own way and makes out that this is a valid or this is valid scholarly research that she's doing, and it's not. She can't be, in my opinion, she can't be believed. And she's a fake and a fraud, although those might seem like strong words. But in the end, that's what it comes down to. And I'm going to try to demonstrate that in the show, the rest of the show today, because it's a lot to call somebody that. But I think it's not too extreme. I think it has to be said. So I would like to ignore her. I really would like to ignore her, but because of her subject matter, I feel that I don't have any choice but to finally respond to what she is saying and explain what's wrong with it and why it shouldn't be accepted. So I'm going to deal today with the paucity of her research and the way she selects what fits her in what I consider her actual anti-German thesis is what it really is, although she thinks she's pro-German. She comes across as saying she's pro-German when she's actually anti-German, and she ignores what doesn't fit her thesis. So she just selects things from here and there, from sometimes not very credible writers of books and authors. So this is what I expect you to expect to look for in this show, and I hope I'll be able to do a good job of that. Now, Clark is not German. She has this tremendous interest in Third Reich Germany, but she's not German, but she's actually half Polish from her mother. That's the impression that she has given, which is about all you can go by, because again, when she talks about her ancestry, a little bit of this will come up pretty quickly here. She's very selective about that too. So she doesn't give you a complete rundown of anything ever. But I would say that her mother's Polish, and whatever her father is, I don't know. The name Clark sounds kind of English. But I don't know that she ever talks about her father. She doesn't have to talk about her father, but in talking about her ancestry, she doesn't go into that part from her parents at all. No, she goes all the way back to the year 900 to tell us who what her ancestry is. Anyway, she publishes books that she herself has put together about the Third Reich. That goes along with the description of her. And something that I just recently learned is that she has a newer book out. I don't know if it's her latest book or just one of the latest books, because she likes to publish everything that comes her way. And it's not hard today to publish books. Self-publishing, once you get the hang of it and have the process, it's not that expensive, and you can get any book on Amazon, it appears. So then it looks, you know, there you are. You've got your book on Amazon, and you got reviews and so on, and you can get your friends to review it and saying that good things about it, and you can talk about what a big author you are, because she likes to say now that she's the author of 13 books and counting. But let's go with this Truth for Germany book she wrote. It's called Truth for Germany hyphen an interview. And she stole this title. It's really irritating, you know. She stole this title, Truth for Germany, from the well-known revisionist book by the German Udo Walende. And it's actually, you could even say it's famous, you know, this book. It's been around quite a while. And what this book is an interview that someone that she calls Mourning the Ancient did with her, and it was not just listen to it, but it was put in text form. So she published it as a book, one of her books. And so now this book says it's by Veronica Clark and Mourning the Ancient. Can you imagine? Putting together your co-author of a book that you've written being Mourning the Ancient, in quotes. Somebody with a name like that, pretend name. And it's not by either one of them, but it's an interview that he did with her, so I don't know how that goes. But this book contains a short bio, and it says, this is the information she wants people to know about herself. Veronica earned her Master of Arts in Military History with honors from Norwich University in 2009. Well, now, Norwich University is a online school for the most part. It says the majority of graduate programs are conducted on a distance learning platform. So it's what we used to call mail order school, but now it's called online university, I guess. And it says that the university offers a graduate program and programs in a range of fields. Now, this is all the fields, all the school, all the degree areas you can get: diplomacy, military history, business administration, civil engineering, justice administration, public administration, information assurance, education, nursing, and organizational leadership. That's quite a variety, quite a lot of things for this small school in New Hampshire. And now, of course, they say that they're one of the best schools in the country. But she did get her master's degree from an online institution and on an online platform. So that's something to remember. And also, she has written elsewhere that she got government loans to pay for this education of hers, and she doesn't intend to pay any of it back. She wrote some blogs on a blog that she had for a while. And, you know, did I already say that she puts up blogs and she takes them down again? Every time she wants to say something new or different, she puts up a blog And but it never lasts very long, and eventually you go look for it, it's not there anymore. So this on this blog, she wrote some, this was her asexual blog, that she's asexual, and she was writing about how rotten the government loan program is and how much money you have to pay back because of the interest that's added, and that she was given, she was led to believe, she says, that when she got, when she graduated from this program, she would be highly employable as this, that, or the other thing. And she wasn't employable at all, and she blames them. And so because they fooled her in that way, she doesn't intend to pay back any of that loan. And she probably won't have to either. That's the way these things go. After you don't pay for so long, they can't get any money out of you. Well, and she doesn't make any money on these books of hers that she's so committed to writing. Anyway, it goes on to, she goes on to tell about herself after the military history with honors, master's degree, that she's the author of 13 and counting books on World War II and Third Reich. She is committed to unorthodox research and divergent points of view. Yes, she's divergent. She goes places that nobody else has gone, she hopes. Ancestrally, then now she jumps into, that's all she says about her books. Then she decides to tell about her ancestry. How many people, when they write a bio for a book that they're the author of, describe their ancestry? Well, this is a new thing she's doing, and she even wrote to me about it, telling me all about it, how she's trying to get, she's trying to connect herself as a German in whatever way she can, and she's also gotten a DNA test commercially, you know, from a website, a DNA test, and the results of that she's spreading around. So she says that ancestrally she's a descendant of Heinrich der Vogler, 876 to 936. Wow, that's so far back. I mean, how did she make that? How did she find that out? How does she even know that? How does she do her ancestry through ancestry.com? You know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, there's no reason to believe it. There's no proof of it. There's, you know, unless she posts online a complete family tree. I mean, nobody has any reason to believe what she's saying. But she says that this she's a descendant of Heinrich der Vogler via Sir Richard Fowler of the Third Crusade. She is, and then her DNA test told her that she was 98.5% European. And she was describing all of this on Deanna Spingola's show. But she had sent it to me previously in an email as though I would be interested, you know, and I should go and get one of these DNA tests too, because she thought it was very good and she recommended it. But it said that she was 98.5% European, and also a tiny bit of Mongolian, East Asian, and Ashkenazi. And she adds, then the last sentence of this, another thing that doesn't even fit in to a author bio, she adds that her activism includes serving the underprivileged in her community. And I assume by this she means non-whites. And what is she doing for these people? How is she serving them? We don't know. She doesn't say that, does she? Now, okay, I was going to say that this Norwich College of Graduate and Continuing Studies is sounds very much like a school specializing, well, the whole college, even the one you go to, I guess, sounds like a school specializing in giving new immigrants some kind of basis for employment, because there are schools like this in, say, in California that a lot of Koreans go to. And they get a degree in nursing or health care, which is just what would allow them to go to work in a nursing home or a rest home type place and get a job, you know, supervising, looking after the people who are there, the old people who are there and so on, or in a hospital or whatever, all the kinds of places that are most likely to hire foreigners. And that's what this kind of school makes me think of. So that's just these ties between Veronica and the immigrant population and the underprivileged population, the non-white population. So now on Deanna Spingola's show on July 20th, here's some quotes from Veronica. Now this is the part that they said a lot of things, but wasn't too interested. But this is the part that is important, in my opinion. She starts talking about Germans and herself. She has said that. Did I remember to keep that there? I'm going to say it right now in case I didn't. That she said, "I'm only 5% German, but I feel like a German." Oh, that's right there in the first sentence. Yeah, she says, she starts out, "What is a German? We know what isn't a German." I'm quoting her exactly. She said, "Genetically, I'm only 5% German, but I consider myself German." You know, now, how can you consider yourself German when you're only 5% German? She's not German, but her whole theory is, as others are trying to pass off on everybody, that it's what you identify with. It has nothing to do with biology. You're not biologically one thing or another, or you can be something else if that's what you feel, if you feel like that more, if you want to identify with that. I say I don't agree with that. And this is the first sign of what to me is a big red flag that there's something very wrong going on here. And then from there, Clark says, has the nerve to say, "We." She goes from "I consider myself German" and asking what is a German, and then she includes herself in Germans by saying "we are at least six different races fused together into a people." Well, this is wordplay, you know. This is wordplay, this six different races business that she has taken on from some things that other people have written. And part of that is from the Platterhouse speech, too, the way she interprets it. But then she goes on to say, with the "we" business, "should we call ourselves a people then? A nation? A state-based?" And she doesn't finish that. But how do we do this? And where is the demarcation line between us and Slavdom? There really wasn't a clear line other than geography. That's Clark. And what she's really up to here is in the end to unite Germans and Slavs. That's what she's really after, because she herself is Slavic. And she is not German, but she wants to be German. She's made it very clear. She says, "I feel like I'm a German, and so I consider myself German." Now, she brings up this man, Gunther, a German from, I think, from the Third Reich period. And I didn't take down too much information about him. But he's the one who writes about Germans being made up of six races. But these aren't races that he's talking about, as though you're talking about Asians and Arabs and Africans and so on. But the six races are Nordic, Mediterranean, Dinaric, Alpine, and things like that. I don't think he says Slavic, but she slips this in herself later. And in the Platterhoff speech, Hitler also never mentions Slav as being part of the German makeup. But she's trying to slip in that to not make that distinction between the two. And by she said already, you know, that there's no demarcation line between Germans and Slavs only geography. And then she recommends Christopher M. Hutton's book, about National Socialist Racism. She says that he doesn't say in this book that the Germans thought of themselves as a race, or whatever it is he says about it. It doesn't make it real clear. So then Veronica says, who are we then? If the German people is already bastardized, and that's true, why did the Germans surpass the countries in the north? So according to Clark, she's already assuming, she jumps on everything she can get to say that the German people are a bastard group of people made of all these different races. So there's no real German. How can you even tell what a German is? And then she says that she's saying that the Germans did more than any other European nation. They surpassed every other European nation, including the countries to the north, that is the so-called Nordic countries, Scandinavia, et cetera. And for her, then, that shows that that the Nordics aren't the best of the what you call Aryan or European groups at all, because the race-mixed Germans did better than the more pure Nordic Scandinavians, or have accomplished more. And now, to me, this is just real scheming on her part. She acts like she wants to free Germans and take away all the stigma against Germans in Germany. But she wants to do it. She's doing it by presenting them as race mixed and therefore not racist. Somehow this is supposed to follow, that since they themselves are race mixed, they can't be racist, and they weren't been so in the end, and a lot of National Socialists weren't. And then she goes on with her Platterhoff theory that by 1944 Hitler had come to that conclusion. So this is the sneaky way she's going about all this, and why anybody, you have to pay attention, you know. But I guess you have to care enough, like I do, to pay attention to these things. Otherwise, you can read or listen to her and think that it sounds good, that she's making sense, and so many people say, well, she has so many good things to say. I really enjoy her. She's so smart. Oh, her research is, she has great research. You know, they're not able to judge. These people are not. And it's a shame that we are so dumb. But when you think of just the average people who get on the internet and show some interest in this and listen to it, you can't really expect more, because before the internet, they wouldn't have gotten this information at all. And now they're getting information that they're not equipped to evaluate and understand properly. And so they're accepting it, and they're accepting a lot of things I just say they shouldn't accept, because they don't understand it, and they're wrong about it. They're wrong, and because it has serious consequences. I think I will get to that, the serious consequences, if you haven't understood what they are already. So she talks about Christopher Hutton and recommends him, and I guess I'll go ahead and read this. I don't know how important it is, though, but I'll read some of it that was written on a page about Christopher Hutton. He identifies, supposedly in his books, he identifies the central figures involved in the study of race during the Nazi regime, and traces continuities and discontinuities between Nazism and the study of human diversity in the Western traditions. Whilst Nazi race theory is commonly associated with the idea of a superior Aryan race and with the idealization of the Nordic ideal of blonde hair, blue eyes, and a long skull, Nazi race theorists, in common with their with their colleagues outside Germany, without exception, denied the existence of an Aryan race. After 1935, official publications were at pains to stress that the term Aryan belonged to linguistics and was not a racial category at all. Under the influence of Mendelian genetics, racial anthropologists concluded that there was no necessary link between ideal physical appearance and ideal racial character. In the course of the Third Reich, racial anthropology was marginalized in favor of the rising science of human genetics. However, racial anthropologists played a key role in the crimes of the Nazi state by defining Jews and others as racial outsiders to be excluded at all costs from the body of the German Volk. So he is apparently identifying racial anthropology as being exclusive, where you see others like Jews and maybe Slavs, some of them, and other, of course, Asians and people, mixed people and so on, as outsiders, outside of the body of the German Volk. So the other thing is human science of human genetics does not do that. I don't know what it does exactly, but it we'll get to that. So anyone studying the Third Reich or who is interested in race theory will find this a fascinating, informative, and accessible study. Okay. So then, after talking about him, Veronica Clark asked the question, what is white? It's not Nordic because there's very little Nordic in the German. Now, that's not what Hitler said. Hitler said the basis of the German is the Nordic. But Clark insists that there's hardly any Nordic in the German, and Germans are white or the epitome of white, and so therefore white does not mean Nordic. She says racial anthropology, according to Hutton, was hostile to nationalism because it celebrated a racially hybrid political form. Maybe she didn't say that. Maybe I just wrote that down there. But I don't know. Celebrate a racially hybrid political form. Seems to be contradicting herself a little bit there. There was no German unity. She's making a big thing about the fact that Germany was made up of all these different states with kingly or princes heading them. And who were the main land owners of that area, and so on, and that the unification, which first took place under Bismarck, was something fairly recent. And she says what Hitler struggled with German tribes did not share much in common, is what she says. Then she brings up Phil Marshall Halder, that had such a bad relationship with Adolf Hitler. I think his name was Erich Halder. In any case, Halder, she brings him up as an example of the lack of unity among the Germans. Oh, you know, they couldn't agree on anything. They were at each other's throats all the time. As though the relationship between Halder and Hitler had anything to do with race. It didn't. But she comes up with things. This is an example of the kind of things she selects in order to make her point, which is always totally tenuous and as far as holding anything together. Following talking about the disunity of the Germans, she says, I'm not promoting race mixing. We're all mixed already. So this is one of her themes, you know, that Germans are all mixed. When she says we're, she means the Germans because she considers herself a German now, just because she decided that she would be. So then they comment on all the treason the two ladies do and talk about how disunified Germany was and the problems the Nazis had with unifying. And Clark says the Nazis were all fighting each other and look where it got them. And they both agreed, yes, they lost the war. And then Clark says, we're getting hung up on details just like the Nazis did. I don't know. She was commenting on something that they were talking about. And that was her last statement that I took down. But the theme of this on this program was definitely that Germans are not a race. And this is what she's been working on for a couple of years. I don't know how long she's been working on this, but at least I've been aware of it for a couple of years now. And so now I'm going to move to her appearance on John Friend's Realist Report. And what I figure after listening to this today and took down some things, I figure that what happened was that John Friend asked Fritz Berg to be a guest, and then Fritz Berg accepted and so on. And then Berg wanted to bring Clark along. So in the second hour, Friend says, Veronica Clark is on the board, so let's see if she wants to say anything. It's obviously all prearranged. And Berg says, great, with a whole lot of enthusiasm. Like he'd been waiting for it because it was already like 18 minutes into the second hour before that took place. And Friend then spoke with Clark on the phone, whatever, and asked her if she had anything to add to the program or any questions. And she said, no, not yet. And that was shortly after the second hour started. At 18 minutes into the second hour, Fritz Berg, I guess, got anxious, couldn't wait any longer. He was doing a good show, too. It was Berg always puts on a good program, and he said a lot of interesting things. It was a good program. But then he suggested to Friend that he said, ask Veronica Clark to talk because she has so many interesting things to say. And Clark, though, is not a Holocaust revisionist at all. She hardly ever talks about it. She doesn't know about it. She doesn't study it. She's not very interested in it. But and so she doesn't have anything to say about it. But she starts promoting one of her books instead of answering the question that Friend posed to her. And then at the hour 39-minute mark, it's back to Berg speaking, and Clark breaks in and asks Berg to talk about the falling out between Ingrid Beckert and David Irving, which he does. And then at the 1:47 mark, Clark comes in again and says she thought that the German government had confiscated all of her writings and wanted to know if Fritz would corroborate that. And he said he wasn't sure. Then Clark said, there's a Jewish writer who said the mystery of Hitler's SS is finally solved, which is utter nonsense. Then she repeats the word Stoßstrupp, which is Hitler's shock troops or Hitler's particular, which started he got together very early. And she wants to talk about that. And she's learning German, you know, and she's saying that word in a very exaggeratedly German way. Stoßstrupp. I can't even say it like she said it. Stoßstrupp. She ended up using that German word six times in my opinion, to show off how she could say that word, how she likes saying it. Stoßstrupp. It's Stoßstrupp. it's a little bit, you know, you have to think, you have to pay attention to it. And she did every time. Stoßtrupp. And instead of saying shock troops, you know, which is because she's speaking English and she's speaking to English people, most people listening wouldn't even know what that word, what she was saying when she said that word. But she kept using it. And in the end, she used it 6 times in a short period of time there. And but Berg was not too impressed by that. She seemed to be, she seemed to have brought that up just to use that word. And he said, well, I'm sure you're right, but he didn't know. And at the close of the program, Berg has to suggest to the now quiet Clark that Friend should ask, he said to John Friend, ask Veronica about some of the books she's published. She's a great writer and great publisher of her own work especially. So there's Berg, you know, as though Clark is his, he's her mentor, and you know she's his daughter or something, and he's helping to get attention to her and so on. He's definitely doing that. And so John Friend says, oh, you know, I was actually going to say that, as I've been a fan of Veronica's work for quite some time now, and it's nice to finally connect with her, and I'm glad that she was able to call in and participate today. So maybe, Veronica, we could set up an interview later on down the line here. And Veronica says, yes, that would be wonderful. Then Berg fusses about Veronica's poor sound connection, you know, because he thinks she needs to be heard better. So that's the way that program went. And I'm just saying that, you know, Fritz Berg is an excellent revisionist. He's done a lot of great work, but he's taken on this Veronica Clark a long time ago, because as I've said before, I met her through him long ago when he was already communicating with her, and he knew then that she had this liking and affection for Negroes and Mexicans, and she, the only group that she was against at the time were Jews. And he liked her for some reason. And I know that Fritz is a very romantic, he can, you know, fall in love easily with someone. Not that it's going to be a real relationship, but just, you know, fantasy-like. And he wanted me to talk to her. And maybe I could, he said, talk some sense into her about her multicultural views. And that's when I first emailed with Veronica. And I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to go into it. But this is how long he's been shoring up Veronica Clark in spite of her views, which he never shared. But excuse me, folks. he never shared these views, but he is more and more doing so. He is more and more writing against racism and wanting to portray the Israelis as racists, and putting racists in a very bad light. And so in that, then he goes along to some extent with Veronica Clark. But let's go on now to the Platterhoff speech. And I just want to say that John, I'm not an enemy to John Friend, and John Friend actually, through Margaret Hufstickler, actually helped me out with figuring out some things on Blog Talk Radio, and it was very nice of him. And John Friend is a nice guy. He really is a nice guy, and he's so nice, you see, that he accepts everyone, and he doesn't want to be, he'll talk against the Jews, but in a generalized way. He's even very friendly with certain Jews who are what he would consider good Jews. And, of course, it's known that he can't be so very racially tough because he has a half Filipino daughter who he loves. And so when you get in situations like that, it's a kind of a compromising thing that's just it's just there and it's not going to change or go away. So I consider John Friend to be soft on race. He's pro-white, but he's not anti anything else in particular. And he's another one of those people who thinks that you can be pro-white and not be against anybody, and that works out. But it doesn't really work out, as only a few people seem to understand. And I always hope to reach these people. I don't know how many of the people who understand this will be listening to this program, but I do hope I can hear from you. I don't need to hear from the others because I know, I don't mind though, but I know what they'll say. I would like to have a better idea of how many people, a lot of people talk tough, but when it comes down to specifics, they all of a sudden get weak again, you know, over it. So, but in any case, I think John Friend just doesn't actually connect with a true racial outlook. It's just not in him. He's too nice of a person. And he said that at the end of this program, which is one thing that kind of alarmed me, was that it caused me to do this program today of mine, is that he's long been an admirer of her work and her books. And I thought he would have changed his mind about that, but he didn't appear to the other day when he said that. Now, he, you know, in 2013, no, it was in 2000, that was a program I did. It was in 2012, May 25th, he wrote a review of Veronica Clark's book about the calling, you know, she came out with the idea that that Hitler's talk to the officers at Platterhof in 1944 was his most important speech. And then she published that, and then she went on and did a more elaborate book, if you can say that, on both Hitler's Platterhof speech and Himmler's Posen speech, one of his Posen speeches, and she presented them as being never before read in English, and she got them translated and so on, and this was a big blockbuster, and a lot of people fell for that, and John Friend was one of them, and, you know, they bought that book and read it and thought they were reading something just new, and getting the inside look at something. Well, what John wrote on Amazon was very favorable to Clark, and he wrote that I cannot recommend this book highly enough. Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, that was the title of it, may be the most profound book I have ever read. That's pretty strong. Maybe the most profound book I have ever read, especially Hitler's speech at Platterhof, which comprises most of chapter 3. And he says this is typical of the way John talks. There has been so much information and outright disinformation endlessly promoted by ignorant and oftentimes dishonest individuals of all stripes and political persuasions about Adolf Hitler and National Socialist Germany in general, that I found this short book to be particularly enlightening. Well, truthfully, this short book is just more ignorant, dishonest disinfo about Adolf Hitler and National Socialist Germany. And yet, John Friend couldn't see that because he doesn't really know much about it. And he is taking Clark's word for it, word for word. Everything she says, he's accepting it as being correct and researched and the truth and so on. So the rest of his review, which is not that much, but it's no point in me reading it all, is that he doesn't say anything about the book. He talks about how much it affected him and how profound it is and what he learned from it, but he doesn't say what he learned. You know, he says he learned. He doesn't actually say it that way, but he just talks, as he usually does, about how horrible World War II was and so many lies and so on, and now here finally is some truth. But he doesn't ever give any specifics, as though you could write what he wrote without ever reading the book. You know, just I'm not saying he didn't read it, but he doesn't. He can't speak to the book itself. So he ends again recommending the book highly, as though he is an authority. Even at that time, he thought he was, but that anybody would take a recommendation from on a subject like this. What does he know about it? He doesn't know that much now, and he certainly didn't know. He knew less 2 years ago. a couple of things before I get into the speech is that, and again, boy, it sounds like I'm saying terrible things about John Friend, and he has a lot of friends and people like him. And I don't have anything against him anymore. I think he's a nice guy too. But I know he's a nice guy. But, you know, he's not an authority at all. And there's a lot of people who don't want to have their minds, have to use their minds too much. And so they prefer to stick with and to read blogs by people who don't challenge their mind very much and say the usual things that they're used to hearing. And that's the way I look at those people who read and listen to John and like his so-called work, because it isn't really work. It's just repeating what the work that other people have done, and not really except in his conspiracy theory stuff. But in World War II and Hitler stuff, it's really nothing of note there. So so forgive me, folks, please, for I'm not trying to attack John. I'm just trying to put John Friend in his place when it comes to any kind of World War II revisionism, including Holocaust revisionism. He might be on the right side, but he's not the right person to argue for it. So the Platterhof Hotel, I didn't know what it was before, actually, but it was built at the site of the Pension Moritz, where Adolf Hitler used to come often. And, you know, we talked about that on the Table Talk program on Thursday, and the previous week also mentioned the Platterhof and the things up there on Obersalzberg, and especially Pension Moritz. And here's the story of that. It was bought in 1877 by Mauritia Moritz Meyer. She bought that estate and opened it as the Pension Moritz. After her death, it became known as the Platterhof because it was thought that she, Mauritia, was the inspiration for the character Judith Platter in the novel Two People, a famous novel at the time that everybody talked about. There's a character, Judith Platter, who ran a hotel, I think, and they thought that this Mauritia was the inspiration for that. So they started calling her place, after she died, they started calling it Platterhof, meaning Platter House, or Platter, you know, Hof is an inn or a place to stay. In 1943, necessities of war turned the Platterhof into a military hospital and rest home. The complex included a large multi-story garage building with quarters on the upper floors for the hotel staff. It was owned and operated by the National Socialists because everything up there on Obersalzberg, around where Hitler lived, had been bought up and taken over so that there wouldn't be any, he would have the privacy he needed. And from Giesler's Valkyrie, I came across the Platterhof too, in his from Giesler's book, Ein Anderer Hitler, in the section about the four parts about the Valkyrie plot, he writes in part one, at the end of June 1944, for instance, Speer called the leaders of the defense industry, the armaments industry, and the directors of the building industry to Linz and urged their utmost effort to increase the production of the armament industry. That Linzer convention ended with Adolf Hitler's speech at the Platterhof at the Obersalzberg. So I guess on that same weekend, or whatever, it was not a weekend, but the same period of time, I don't know, it was one day, but they had all these discussions going on. And according to Giesler, that was the end of that was when Hitler gave his talk to the officers up at the Platterhof, which was part of the National Socialist structural buildings up there. And Giesler says, Speer and I were Hitler's guests that evening at the Berghof, that after Hitler's speech. He said, after dinner, Speer said with urgency, Giesler, find a moment to tell Hitler about the Linz Convention and let him know that I ended it with the performance of Bruckner's Fourth Symphony at the Aula of the St. Florian Abbey. Well, this was just Speer getting Giesler to bring up this thing to Hitler that Speer had done that he knew Hitler would like, because Bruckner was his favorite symphony composer. And that was one of his favorite symphonies. And so Giesler says, Speer knew how much Hitler liked that symphony. Late that evening, he suggested, my Führer, I propose that Giesler should tell some funny anecdotes. Well, I would see, Giesler hadn't done it. So in order to spur him on, Speer then says out loud to Hitler that Giesler should tell some funny anecdotes and force Giesler to do what he wanted him to do, tell the story he wanted him to tell. And Giesler says, with Speer, everything was practical and calculated. This kind of reminds me of the John Friend show with Fritz Berg and Clark, where Berg kept prompt John to talk to Veronica. It's kind of funny. So it's, you know, people are pushing their own little agendas. Well, we all do. Now, the platter, I'm only going to, I've got the whole thing here, but I'm going to it's so long, and there's certain parts of it that are that have meaning that I want to talk about. So I'm starting on what I'm calling page 8, but he's talking about tolerance and nature not being tolerant. And this is Hitler speaking to these officers. It was in the crucial period of time, June 1944, when he was trying to keep them focused on victory and on the future and on the possibilities that still existed and on what needed to be done and why. And he said in the beginning of the speech, let's see, let me repeat that. I put that on the program post, but he said at the beginning of his speech he says, gentlemen, even though I am sure this has been discussed already, I would nevertheless like to point out the reason for the course I have taken. An enormous revolution has taken place, or upheaval, maybe, has taken place among the Germans. This has perhaps not been noticed by Germans, since it was they who had that inner experience, but it was noticed by foreigners who could see the results of this upheaval at that time. This upheaval was, because it did not happen with lightning speed, as in the revolution of 1918, but appeared slowly, as in an evolution, largely unnoticed by people who, because of their profession and work, only gradually became aware of it. So he's talking about his National Socialist Revolution. And so I'll go back to what he said later. So then he's saying, if I have accepted a view as being correct, then it is not only my duty to make citizens of a state aware of it, but to eliminate contrary views. This may sound intolerant, but gentlemen officers, all of life is a continuation of intolerances. Nature teaches that. Nature is intolerant towards all that is not right, weak, that is weak, primarily against weakness. Nature is primarily against weakness, he's saying. Nature eliminates all that is weak, starting with primitive life forms. A bitch will push a weak little one trying to suckle away. Why? We don't know, but she will let it die. We believe this to be cruel, but in reality, it is right. Well, right here, Hitler's giving his true views, and they haven't really changed. He's talked like this in Table Talk. We're in January 1942 now, but he's been speaking, you know, like this from time to time, from the start of it, all during 1941. And he spoke like this in Mein Kampf and so on. So he sees that what nature is the model to follow, not the Christian model. And he never really did believe in the Christian model, even though he said in early speeches that he was Christian, that he admired Christ, and as a Christian, he felt it necessary to do this, that, and the other thing. But he was always speaking about the Jews when he said that. He was always speaking of Christ as a Jew fighter, and that as a Christian, he needed to do the same. That's basically what his argument was when he used it, when he said it in those ways. And now he says all through this speech, here and there, different places and different ways, that that nature is ruthless, nature is cruel, but nature is right. It's not cruel in the long run. It just seems cruel to us because we feel sorry for the things that are weak. But if you look at it truthfully, in a country, and Hitler emphasized that at one place at least, that towards the end, he said that we're in a life and death struggle, and we cannot forget that we're in a life and death struggle, and this kind of weakness, you know, will do us in. So we have to understand that, and we have to do what's necessary. I guess that's enough for that for now. But this is pretty contrary to Veronica Clark's views and her vision of Hitler. She wants a different Hitler. You know, already said that she was taking care of the underprivileged. She said she was looking out for the underprivileged. That was part of her activism in her community. And everything, other places, she said that she praises Hitler for looking after the working classes and so on. there's lots of reasons for that, and I'm not saying they're not, there's no kindness there. But you have to put things in their proper context when Hitler's talking about certain things, and he's talking about other things, and he has a more tolerant point of view. When he's talking about fighting for the survival of Germany, then it's a different story. And this again emphasizes, as I hope to point out, that his concern is for Germany. It's always for Germany. It's not for the Aryan race at this juncture. It's not for it's not for Europe at this juncture or anything like that. It's for his whole focus is on the Germans. Let's see. He says tolerance. It's madness to believe that political views must be tolerant. Tolerance can only be understood as a sign of insecurity. At the moment when I am certain to have solved a problem, I've developed a certain view, it becomes not only my right but my duty to eliminate all other views. Maybe I already read that. I don't know. Let me move in the position, trying to skip what I don't need to say, because I want to get to the race thing first, and then I can talk about it. But this just sets the tone for his attitude as he's talking to these officers. He says, when I state the above as a politician, then I state something that must naturally be the basis for all actions taken by an officer. For an officer can make use of anything except a tolerant point of view. An officer cannot make use of a tolerant point of view, he's saying, meaning that when an officer is faced with a problem, a task, a necessity, he not only has the right to address this necessity, but the duty to eliminate all that stands in the way. He's saying that a problem that an officer faces or a task that an officer is given is a necessity. It's a necessity that he fulfill it. It's a necessity, it needs to be seen as a necessity that he succeed in that task, that he carry out what was intended for him to accomplish. And when something is a necessity, then nothing can stand in the way. He says the necessity, this necessity, he says he has to eliminate all that stands in the way. And every officer will face this during the course of his leadership. So he's encouraging, because of the situation they're in Russia, and the front moving further to the west all the time, that they must use all means and all force to accomplish the battles that they're in, to accomplish victory, that nothing no kind of tolerance or nothing can stand in the way of that. Whatever has to be done must be done. Whatever has to be done must be done to succeed. And in this mood, I'm sorry. You know, I knew when I got to this I'd have to. Okay, I think I should go all the way down here. All right. In this mood, he goes on to I'll start up here. He says, however, gentlemen, when I began my apprenticeship 25 years ago, that would have been in 1919 from the time he was speaking, and that's really the beginning. He says, this was not so, whatever was not so. I was always told by middle-class bourgeois circles, yes, people and race are one and the same. No, he says, people and race are not the same. Race is a component of blood, a blood nucleus, but the people are very often composed not of one race, but of two, three, four, or five different racial nuclei. Even so, it is not possible or even desirable to dismantle such a united body of people, but in the course of political development, such a solution may occur anyway. So when he's speaking of two, three, four, or five different racial nuclei, he's not talking about different races like people generally think of when they think of race. So that you'd say, oh, the Germans are a mixed race. They've got everything in them. He's just saying that there's different racial nuclei that make up a race, that make up a blood race, a race united by blood. And he's saying, and he goes on to talk about racial composition and how it influences what Germans are and do. Then, then, with it, a question was to be decided. Namely, was the breakdown in 1918 the end of the German nation? Or, this was the view of many, that it was the end. Was it not, and this was my conviction, the beginning of a new national body? So he says when the German nation broke down in 1918, he saw it as the beginning of a new national body. Generally, doesn't a breakdown have to come in order to liquidate by hook or by crook a state which is unbearable in the long term? I will have to speak rather briefly as to the reasons for this, because they lie a bit deeper than commonly seen, but also because these are problems that are not suitable for discussion before the masses. He says, we have this people of ours that are not to be defined as a race, and that is now clear to millions. Now, this is the sentence that Clark makes a whole lot out of, that it is translated this way anyway, that we have a people that are not to be defined as a race, and that is now clear to millions. That's kind of an inscrutable sentence. However, he goes on following that to say, however, gentlemen, when I began my apprenticeship 25 years ago, this was not so. So he says it was not 25 years ago, it was not so, but it is so today that these people are not defined as a race. Then he says, 25 years ago, I was always told by middle-class bourgeois circles, yes, people and race are one and the same. Now, it's funny that he is using, and then he says, no, people and race are not the same. But middle-class bourgeois circles wouldn't be the radical nationalists at all. But the middle-class bourgeois were the ones who thought that when you talked about the people, you were talking about a race. But Hitler is saying, no, that's not the same thing. He says race is a component of blood, a blood nucleus. But the people are very often composed not of one race, but of two, three, four, or five different racial nuclei. Now, is that a repeat of what the sentence I already read? I guess not. Even so, he says, it is not possible or even desirable to dismantle such a united body of people, but in the course of political development, such a solution may occur anyway. In other words, I say the folk are not the Aryan race or the white race or even the German race, but they are the German people, the German nation. And by the way, that German nation does not include Poles like Veronica, Polish people like Veronica. Going on, Hitler says, when one looks at the German people from the purely biological point of view, then we see here, I would say, a society with a common language united by detour of state building, but a people, and that is perhaps the most significant factor, of varied racial origins, a Nordic racial nucleus, some Mediterranean racial nuclei, even a European core race. I think by that he's talking about the old European, or maybe even that supposedly there's something called the old European, and might even include the Neanderthal. I'm not sure. And he says a prehistoric race which we cannot define exactly, but which is there, and was already there with the Greeks, and the Helots of Sparta came from this same race. And he says that racial core also exists within our people. So here he's making it more clear that he's not talking about Asians, Arabs, Africans. He is talking about simply variations on the white race, the Nordic, the Mediterranean, and the European core race, and the prehistoric race, which he says was already in the Greeks. And he said on Table Talk on Thursday that when we look at the origin of the German people, we should not be looking at the Neanderthals. I don't know if he was talking about Neanderthals. He should. But he said we should be looking at the Greeks. He thinks that the Germans have a racial affinity with the classical Greeks. excuse me. I've got something in my throat here. Oh, yeah, I wrote it down here from Table Talk on Thursday. I should look ahead a little bit. A skull is dug up. He said, this is what he said. This would have been in January 1942. A skull is dug up by chance, and everybody exclaims, "That's what our ancestors were like." Who knows if the so-called Neanderthal man wasn't really an ape, Hitler asked. What I can say in any case is that it wasn't our ancestors who lived there in prehistoric times. The soil we live on must have been so desolate that our ancestors, if they passed that way, certainly continued their journey. When we are asked about our ancestors, we should always point to the Greeks. Now, this shows, too, though, that he's saying, who knows if the so-called Neanderthal man wasn't really an ape? And he also said in another place, when he's talking about herbivores and carnivores, he said the monkeys, our ancestors of prehistoric times, are strictly vegetarian. So Hitler was believing in strict Darwinianism at this time, I would say, towards, you know, the last years of his life. That was pretty much accepted then. The controversy around all that came about later, you know, since that time. But he seemed to, as though he accepted that we, the whole story of evolution, that we went from ape to man somehow. This has to do with his view of the races, because, you know, he's saying that just because people lived here doesn't mean that we're descended from these people. Our true ancestors may have passed by and then come back. There was a lot of roaming around. So he's saying that there's a lot of this different, what he's calling racial nuclei, which are simply the various forms of European, I don't know if they're call them races or what, which is he's defining as the Nordic, the Mediterranean, including a prehistoric bloodline and the old European core race, all that mixed together, which doesn't make you race mixed in the sense that it seems to me that Clark is trying to imply. He says, Hitler goes on, and it's kind of funny that he's talking about this in this speech to the officers, because it's sort of an aside that he gets into and starts speaking about. I don't know what why he felt it was important to say these things, or maybe he just felt like saying them. But anyway, he goes on to say, "We see in our people the existence of various racial nuclei. These racial nuclei contain the details as to the special abilities of this bulk. Since these abilities are not primarily abilities of the German people themselves, but rather racial abilities." So now again, he's distinguishing between what he considers the German people or the Volk, which are so important in his mind, and the various racial qualities that are inherent in these people. And he is then going to say that all the Germans don't feature the same racial qualities or these abilities, because he names them as things like mathematically inclined and artistically inclined and stuff, which is not very, I don't think it's very scientific. It's just the way he's putting it. He says the German people, he does think there's a German people, currently possess a number of racial nuclei appears, after all, have to read this right, appears in the wealth of their capabilities. He's saying that the German people have a wealth of capabilities, and these racial nuclei carry certain dispositions in themselves. The Nordic race is more inclined to cold weather, is mathematically inclined, and is exceptional in organizational ability. That's how he sees the Nordic race, and he thinks that's the premier bloodline in the German people. Not small, as Clark has said. It's just a tiny part. There's hardly any Nordic in the Germans, Clark says, but he didn't think so. He thought it was the number one, the best, but also he thought it was prevalent, plenty prevalent in the German Volk. And then he says other racial nuclei contain a very artistic disposition with a purely optical talent. And then he says there are race nuclei with very strong musical talents and race nuclei with exceptional commercial talents. And these commercial talents are strongest among jewelry. So, but they lack creativity, he said. So he was even including jewelry in the racial nuclei of the German Volk, it seems to me. Maybe he's not including them. Maybe he's just saying that this particular commercial talent is most strongly possessed by Jews. You see, it's hard because of the way how this is translated, to know exactly, you know, to say, well, this means he thought this or he thought that, because so often, as I've pointed out in with Table Talk, he's talking, and he starts getting on to something, and he's I think that he likes talking out loud. He did a lot of it, because he formed his ideas as he was doing that, in that he would speak out what he was thinking, and maybe then he would improve what he was thinking by once he heard it spoken, and maybe saw it written down if it was taken down. And that's how he developed that's one of his methods of developing his thinking and his ideas. So I don't take any of this as unless he said it over and over again. I don't take it as, this one sentence here shows that he felt this way or he felt that way. Because this seems to me to be that he's just sort of going on and on about it, and it may be that his listeners are starting to nod off, or maybe they didn't show it, but having a hard time following what he's getting at, because I'm actually having a hard time. I have a hard time following it. And I don't think it sounds all that important either. And I don't think it sounds like what Clark is trying to say that it means. But let's go on, because there's more. And he says, we now have a combination of these racial nuclei within our people. However, it is now crucial, because of the multitude of abilities in the German people, that I encourage those racial nuclei to emerge, which are the original carriers of these abilities. In other words, I must see to it that the talents of a particular racial nucleus gradually emerge throughout the entire German people. So he is wanting to bring out, it's basically just saying he wants to bring out the best. You know, he wants to bring out the best of what is there in the German people, and make it available more to every German, make it more prevalent in all Germans, bring out the best. This is part of the Every time I try to think of that word, I come up with euthanasia. It's the other one where you're improving the race. He's simply part of his thinking about improving the race and to take the best parts of what's in Germans and make that more the common quality of Germans and the common experience of Germans, of all Germans, so that you don't have good Germans and bad Germans, you know, and healthy Germans and sickly Germans and smart Germans and stupid Germans and so on. He wants to improve Germans across the board and continue to do so that they're less different and divided and more similar and united. Which doesn't bode well for the idea that you're going to bring in different races, and that's perfectly all right, because he's never, ever been for anything like that. So he says this doesn't come about simply by asking who appears to be talented. Rather, the miracle reveals itself when the call is finally answered. In other words, if I hit a certain piano key, a corresponding string responds by virtue of the design of the piano. And if I look for a certain talent or am allowed the freedom to choose, those people will respond who by their very nature, due to the talents inherent in their race, are best suited. Well, I hope that's self-explanatory. Then he says, this is now crucial for the leadership of the nation because, as is apparent, only the Nordic racial component has real value due to its organizational ability. Yep, that's what he said. And he said, throughout the process of selection, this will, in the end, always be the picture that emerges. However, one should not assume that this was the picture from the start, because nature shows us that in crossing of two parents with a variety of talents and abilities, those talents and abilities do not always come to the boy from the father or to the daughter from the mother, but on the contrary, a cross occurs, so that if a Nordic man married, shall we say, an Eastern woman, and he's distinguishing there, the child would not necessarily be a Nordic male, but completely Eastern-oriented instead, which he wouldn't think is as good. He doesn't like that as much. He says, for example, in any crossbreeding, and he's calling it crossbreeding, it can easily happen that the organizational talent of the Nordic nucleus is forced into the background in favor of another talent. So he's calling the mixing of Nordic and Eastern, which I assume he's meaning Slav. I can't say for sure. He's calling that crossbreeding, and he is saying that. The Eastern might force into the background the Nordic, which would be unfortunate in his eyes. And he says, now if I have a society organized on the basis of, I don't know if this is important, on the basis of purely capitalistic development, which has nothing to do with Nordic leadership talent, it will still form an upper class, and it will then be possible that over time this upper class will consist not of Nordic peoples, but of racial elements that have a penchant for being led. That was the tragedy of the old German Reich. Now, I've got a note here that Veronica leaves this part out. I don't know where I worked on this before some months ago, you know, on comparing these things, and I don't know exactly what I meant, but I'm saying that Veronica Clark stops here, and then I say at the bottom, notice what she left off, this last part, it will still form an upper class, and it will then be possible that over time, this upper class will consist not of Nordic peoples, but of racial elements that have a penchant for being led. He's talked about that a number of times on Table Talk. So I take it from that what he means by those who are willing to be led, he means the Slavic. That's what he's referring to. And he's saying clearly that he wants the upper class to consist mostly of the Nordic racial element. And we know that that's what they were aiming at with the SS. Create that the very best of the German race, if you put it, but he doesn't call it a race, the very best of the German people to be the leadership, because he doesn't want people who are willing to be led, who want to be led. He wants leaders. He's even talking in this speech here about developing leadership and leaders and how important that is. So let's see if we can get to that part. He's talking about the experience of driving through the country and stopping at having to stop at a construction site, a road construction on the road, and as they're stopped, he notices that there's in the cars ahead of him, there's one has a rich Saxon industrialist, and another car has an equally rich person, but with a noticeably un-Nordic appearance, and that the road workers, he says, especially if this happened in Northwest Germany, they had fantastic appearances. The road workers, and naturally expressed absolute contempt for the occupants of said vehicles, complete contempt. Those road workers were more suited for leadership than the ones sitting in the cars. Now, this to me clearly reveals, whether you approve of it or not, you see, but it reveals Hitler's strong attention to racial traits and his belief that racial traits count very much in the long run. In fact, they are what counts the most. So the best and most Nordic of the Germans must be found to lead. And this is a very racialist view. It's not a non-racialist view. And he's expressing it very clearly in this speech. Just because he makes a couple of statements that talk about the German people are made up of six different races, and then he defines races as this racial nuclei of all... that Western Europeans are made up of, it's kind of, you can't take from that. But that's what Clark has done. She's taken from that and created this whole theory of hers. Hitler becoming, losing all of his racial feeling, compunctions and, being, in essence, a tolerant multiracialist. Now, he goes on to talk, and he's making it very clear that he says that the Jews here, now he's talking about the Jews, that the Jews are the problem. He never loses sight of the fact that without the Jews, any country will just improve so much and do so much better, that it's the Jewish element in the country that is destroying the good that it could have. And he uses Hungary as an example, as he's done before in elsewhere, and said the whole state is decayed and corroded. Jews everywhere, right up to the highest position. Jews upon Jews, the whole of the state, one network of spies and agents. And I have to say, he says, Jews have made it their purpose to eliminate the German peoples. I explained this to the Reichstag on September 1st, 1939, stating that if someone believes that the German nation will be eliminated through war, then he is mistaken. If Jewry will realize this, which means if Jewry ends up destroying Germany through war, then Jewry will be eliminated. And this was brought lively a pause. And I've got a note here that says Clark is contributing to the elimination, destruction of the German people by saying there is no such thing as a German people. Clark is obviously saying there's no such thing as a German people because it's all race mixed. And therefore she, as a Pole, and she went into that even more than I spoke about on her program with Deanna Spingola, that it's all about how you I tried to get that across, I suppose I did, that it's all about how you identify yourself. It has nothing to do with biology. By doing that, she wants to say anybody can become German. And that's what we're fighting right now, is all these non-whites, non-Germans, but it's just not just non-whites. It's any non-Germans going into Germany are screwing up Germany. And non-Italians going into Italy are screwing up Italy. I mean, non-Poles going into Poland are screwing up Poland, and they don't want that either in Poland. And they don't have it because nobody goes to Poland. The Poles are leaving. The Poles leave to go to Britain, especially, and Germany and other places, Italy, any place they can work. And so do the other Slavic nations and the Eastern. I shouldn't always say Slavic because there's Eastern nations that aren't Slavic. But nobody's going to them. But it's the Western nations that are being invaded by people that are not their people. And what Clark is saying is, well, they're not a people. There's no such thing as a German people. So it doesn't matter. That's what why I say she is, this is an anti-German position. She portrays herself as a champion of Germany, a champion of truth for Germany, a champion of truth about the Third Reich. And yet she is more and more criticizes Adolf Hitler when she's, it depends on where she is and who's listening to her and what her topic is. But I have heard her really just about tear into Adolf Hitler and all the mistakes he made and all the bad things he did. And he's certainly not perfect, and he certainly needs to be criticized, and just really putting him into a very place equal to just about everybody else, you know, rather than the great leader that she used to portray him as. You know, when she first started out, she went overboard in idolizing Adolf Hitler. Now she's gone more and more. She's pretty far in the other direction, where I could imagine her becoming absolutely anti-Hitler eventually. Maybe that's where she's headed. And maybe she knows all this already, or maybe she doesn't. Maybe it's just happening to her, and she's not aware of the destructive quality of what she's doing, because she doesn't identify with anything. She doesn't identify with any nationality. She doesn't identify as an American, although she is one. She wants to identify as a German, but in a German nation that no longer exists, really, see. And she doesn't identify, I guess, much as a woman or as a female, although she does to the extent that she thinks that these white nationalists are anti-women, and she's right. To some degree, she's right about a lot of them. They are. A lot of them are, but they're not all. I don't know. She doesn't identify with much of anything. She's very much an individualist. She has said that she's a libertarian. She's some kind of a special libertarian. I forget now what it is. That it's on Wikipedia. In everything she is, like asexual and this libertarian thing, which was actually formed and run by Jews, this type of libertarian that she says she is. So she's completely individualistic. People need to realize this woman, you know, I haven't said these words yet, but to me this woman is injecting poison into this movement or these various movements whatever you want to think of them. But she's certainly injecting poison into those who are pro Hitler and pro Third Reich and anti Holocaust. She is really poison to these groups, and yet so many in these groups embrace her and say, "Oh, she's so interesting." Still, even though I don't agree with everything she says, I like to listen to it because her research is so good. Her research is not good. These people don't know anything about research. They don't know anything about it. How can they, yet they're impressed for that very reason. They're impressed because they don't know any better. John Friend is just one example of radio hosts and people in this movement that have blogs and so on, who say that they're for this and that, who should think again about who they are inviting on their programs and what they are offering to their listeners without any criticism, without any scrutiny whatsoever. And he'll just be praising, just like Deanna does. "Oh, you're so wonderful. You're just so wonderful." He'll be doing that too, and going along with her, because these nice people can't help themselves. They just can't. And then everybody likes them because they're so nice, and they think that's the way to be. Well, let me go on here. I've done my little kind of summing up here, so I'm going to see if I can find some more points here. I've got something right following this. Hitler says, "Believe me, the people are not able to decide that for themselves." That about the Jews. He says, "Often I have been asked, well, why don't you let the people decide in this matter? I have always made the Hitler says, "I have always made the decisions and then asked the people, are you in agreement with this decision? But I never expected the people to make this decision." Well, this is very important, because this is the leadership that they had. Democracy pretends that the people are deciding and then telling their political representatives, and then that is carried out by the government, and the people's will is being done, and nothing could be further from the truth. And it has never been like that. Never, ever, ever been like that. Except, in some little group, maybe. Some small group about some issue or whatever might function that way. But nothing functions that way. Democracy doesn't work like that. So Hitler's idea is that the leader is responsible, and the leader has to make decisions, because the people are not capable as a joint group of making these decisions. And then you get their feedback afterwards, and that feedback you have to will mean something to you for the next time. So let's see. Oh well, I came to the end, didn't I? Yeah, I did. All right. Well, that's pretty good timing. So I'll go on and read the rest of this. If the leadership, from the speech, if the leadership is unable to muster the courage to make a decision, can I expect the common people of my folk to make it? When the deep thinkers are unable to agree, then somebody has to make a decision. And that is what is beautiful about the officer profession. It is obvious, impossible to let the company decide, or the battalion, or even my subordinate officer, what decision has to be made. But one has to be made, and if it has to be made in a critical situation, then that officer can be proud to have made it when he accepted the responsibility, knowing full well that at times he could be wrong, that it is not important. They applauded at that. Well, there was lots of applause during this talk. But he says, better to be wrong than to allow the masses to have the conviction that they are in charge, that the decision rests with them. That would be synonymous with a declaration of abandonment of leadership, a declaration of cowardice. That must never happen. When you think of this type of leadership, and people lose sight of this, they seem to think that, you know, they want to make Hitler into Mr. Good Guy, and then they start putting their own ideas of good onto him, which are often very wrong. What he's saying is that that if you're unwilling to make the decisions that a leader has to make, then it's a sign of cowardice, because it's your job to make that decision, even knowing that you could be wrong. Anytime anybody could be wrong, but you have to make a decision, because otherwise you have a stalemate, and we know that that happens in so many governments, and then you have a decision made by other means, not even further afield from the people, from the people's will, because they're stalemate amongst the people's representatives. Now, I can go to, I've got 3 minutes. I could let somebody call in. If anybody wants to call in the last minute or so, I'm looking, but I'm going to, I'm looking at the, and I could look at my email to see if there's anything that has come in, usually not. So where is that refresh? Well, I can't find it. Where is it? Oh. Darn it. Now I'm wasting my time now. Oh, there it is. Didn't recognize it. No. I'm going to the entire Blatterhouse speech. Well, let me just say that I think I do need to say this before the end of the show, that that these few sentences, and I've read all that there is in here about race, do not add up to what Veronica Clark says they add up to. They're kind of vague, and in all the rest of the speech, he makes a big deal about the German people and his that there is such a thing as the German people, and there is a Volk, and how much he cares about the German people, and that's really all he cares about at this point, because he's fighting for Germany at this point, and then later he could have concerns for a larger European units and so on. But at this point, it's all to protect the Germans, and he finds the Germans to be so valuable. And it's not just chauvinism on his part, but he really does find them to be that valuable, that he needs, that the German people need to be saved, and they need to endure for the good of all. That's how he looks at it. So to say that he thought so little of the German people that anybody could join in, and they were just a mixed race that had no that only self-identified with one another, would not be accurate as a way to define Hitler's views. I might have to pick this up again at a later time. I might get some criticism about this show, and then I'll have to respond to that. So I'll say goodbye for now. Have a nice weekend. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn.